Well, good afternoon, everybody, or actually good morning here in Arizona. And I think it's probably late afternoon, evening in the UK. My name is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore. And we're here with another of our virtual events. And we're very pleased and honored to have Jeffrey Archer here with us today. He's gonna be discussing his brand new book, Over My Dead Body. And this is a Poison Pen Bookstore first. We've never done a program with Lord Archer, and we're really, really pleased to have him with us. Barbara's standing by with the book there, and I have some signed copies. Mr. Archer was very kind to sign a whole bunch of them for us. And so I'll go ahead and put a buy link in the comments field on Facebook, and I'll try to do it on YouTube as well. But, and also if you have any questions for Lord Archer, go ahead and put them in the comments field, and I'll be happy to ask anything. So Barbara, I'm gonna turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. This is really a great pleasure. And I was thinking when Patrick was holding up the book that normally I read what's called an advanced reading copy, which is this volume here. And it occurs to me that because there was a space, that a disadvantage to that is that you don't get some of the extras that the finished copy has. And so before I put it down, I want to show you this nifty diagram, because it's integral to the solving of one of the mysteries in the book. So Jeffrey, he's asked me to call him Jeffrey. Jeffrey, that's a really golden age kind of a thing, isn't it, to put in a diagram?
Yes, of course, if you go back a century or more with Charles Dickens, they did real drawings, wonderful illustrations. But when I described that in the book, and there's eight people sitting around a table, two at the top plus two fours at the side, 10 in all. One of them is a murderer. And you have to decide, reading the page, which one it is. But then my editor, who has got a very large brain, she said, I think we ought to let the people know where everyone is sitting. So when they see the diagram, they might be able to work out who committed the murder.
I love it. And that's one of the cases involved. And we'll come back to that. But first, I'd like to introduce Jeffrey. If you're watching this, you probably think I don't need to. But I did think of a couple of things that might not be so obvious. And one of them is when Jeffrey was a student at Oxford, he was also a Blue, which is an athlete. And I think that might have been an excellent kind of card to play when you ran for office, because you were elected to office at Oxford. And then you went on to be elected an MP at the age of 29 for a district in Lincolnshire. And now you've served in the House of Lords for nearly three decades. So I bring that up because I wonder, you clearly wanted to be a politician. Did you also want to be an author, or did the author grow out of the politics, or were the politics a way of subsidizing the chancy time of being an author?
Very good question. And actually, when I left Oxford, I wanted to be a politician and was elected to what we call the London Council, far too young. I was only 25. And actually, you're right, I was elected to the House of Commons at the age of 29, again, far too young. I now regret those two. I advise people in this country going into politics, don't go in until you're about 40. Then you'll have gained some experience and possibly some financial security, and you'll have more time and experience to give to politics. So the answer to your question is, I came to writing by mistake. I am, in the words of Proust, someone who ended up doing the thing they're second best at. I wanted to be a politician. I wrote my first book, not a penny more, not a penny less, it was 49 years ago. But it was in your country, I remember the big breakthrough for me was Cain and Abel. That sold worldwide 1 million copies in the first week, has now sold 37 million copies and been read by 100 million people. And that as you can imagine, Barbara, changed my whole life overnight. I've been writing ever since because I love it, I enjoy it, and I'm always delighted to speak to America. I've had a love affair with America for most of my life. I had the privilege of being up at Oxford with Bill Bradley, who became a senator, of course, and we've remained close friends for 50 years. Indeed, when Mary and I had been married for 40 years, he did the main speech, and very brilliant it was. And I've had many other connections with American politicians and with Americans. So my affection for your country goes back a long way and continues. I want there to be a strong relationship between Great Britain and America, and not some people seem to dismiss the fact that in our history, we owe a great deal of our freedom and our democracy because America was with us when we most needed them.
Well, we've had an interesting long history. I only read today, as a matter of fact, in either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, I think it was the Journal, about malaria. And it pointed out, because there's a malaria vaccine that's just becoming available, pointed out that when the surrender came at Yorktown, it was in part because the British troops were so decimated by malaria, that they were unable to fight. And it made me think about, when we study history, it's so hard to take all the factors into account. I mean, malaria, I can't recall, has ever come up in a study of our Revolutionary War, but there it was.
And indeed, it was a distinguished Cambridge scientist who won the Nobel Prize for his work on malaria. And if you see his portrait in his college at Cambridge, and not only is the portrait there, but the malaria bug is in the corner to remind people how he got the Nobel Prize.
So as Jeffrey points out, Cain and Abel was a major hit. It was also TV, and there's no question that TV can really accelerate a writer's career. So at this point, according to the biography from your publisher, you've world sales of over 275 million copies. And I think this is fascinating. You're the only author ever to have been a number one bestseller in three categories: fiction, short stories, which many people I've noticed really admire, and nonfiction for The Prison Diaries. So that's really a remarkable achievement to have, topped the list in all three.
Yes, I'm very proud of that, but I'm very touched by your comments about the short stories, because I've written 92 short stories in six groups in my life, and I'm a huge admirer of the short story. And I learned so much from F. Scott Fitzgerald, a great short story writer, and O. Henry, another great short story writer. And in those days, we had in our country Somerset Maugham, and we also had Saki, H.H. Munro. The French had Maupassant. You have more experience than I do across the board, Barbara, but it doesn't seem to me this is a great age for the short story, and I have been determined to keep it alive.
Well, I could say to you that part of that, Jeffrey, is because the vehicles for publishing short stories kind of disappeared. Sherlock Holmes and the Strand Magazine, for example, Dickens, serial, many novels were published serially because there were publications that did that. And what is bringing the short story back in part is digital publishing, because, an ebook short story can, the economics of publishing it dramatically different than trying to publish it in just a print form. You might be aware that Eric Larson has just published a book only in digital. He elected to test that out. So I think you'll find that the short story market is actually picking up thanks to all that. And so you should do well with it. But I wanted to ask you something about The Prison Diaries. Did you write those to pass the time, or did you write those to process the experience, or was it both?
I think it was a clever combination of both. Your suggestion is a clever combination, because it was both. Prison is immensely boring. if you're in what I call a category D, where you frankly may as well be in a care home. And so I wrote every day, and don't forget, I was meeting the most fascinating people, some of them thoroughly evil, some of them stupid, some of them had had bad luck. And so I was able to write down my memoirs, and perhaps more important, I followed it up with A Prisoner of Birth, which some of my attempt to rewrite The Count of Monte Cristo. And that there was another advantage in having that experience. Basically, it was an interesting time for someone who has had a decent education and is articulate. But I look back on it now as being a bit of a waste of time. It would have been much better. One of the leading charities in the country, MenCap, who take care of the mentally ill, wrote to the Home Secretary and said, "We've lost our executive director. Could Jeffrey come from 9 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock at night?" And he said no. And looking back on it, having had so many years in charity work, I would have enjoyed doing that and feel it would have been of more purpose.
Well, I certainly can't quarrel with that analysis. I brought it up in part because this William Warwick series is, he's a detective, and therefore, you know, you could call these crime novels, but I don't know a lot of authors who have any personal experience with some of the things that you're writing about. And I think that puts you in a really special position to be writing this. I read that, and we'll go back and talk about William Warwick and where he appears in the Clifton Chronicles. And well, actually I could say, William Warwick, if I recall right, is a character written by James Clifton, Harry Clifton, sorry, in the Clifton Chronicles. Is that right?
That's right. When I wrote the Clifton Chronicles, my hero, Harry Clifton, a boy born in the back streets of Bristol, and you follow his life, and he becomes a world famous writer, going to number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. And he writes about a detective called William Warwick. And I had so many readers from all over the world writing and saying, we'd like, after the Clifton Chronicles had finished, and they wrote and said, we'd like to know more about William Warwick. So I invented this character who begins school, when he's at school, he wants to join the Metropolitan Police Force, but his father is a distinguished lawyer, a QC, a Queen's Counsel, and he wants him to join him in chambers and become a lawyer. But he defies his father, joins the police force as a detective, as a constable, and becomes a detective constable in book one, Nothing Ventured. So where you're right, you're quite right, it is a detective story, but it's a story about a detective. And I wanted to follow his life from being the lowest rank constable right the way through. So in book two, he's a detective sergeant dealing with drugs. In book three, he's a detective inspector dealing with police corruption. And the book you have, Barbara, book four, he's now a detective chief inspector, and he's been made head of the murder squad. Now, my problem is that I want to get him, Barbara, all the way from constable, all the way through to commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. So in the next book, he'll be a superintendent. The book after, he'll be a chief superintendent. The book after, he'll be a commander. And finally, he will be commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. Now, you can read any of the books because they're a separate crime with him at a separate rank. So you can join in with Over My Dead Body, where William has been put in charge of solving four unsolved cases, because his commander feels that if you get away with murder, you might do it again. So there is one problem, Barbara, which I have, is that I have to live to the age of 86 in order to get William to be commissioner of the Metropolitan Police.
Right, I see you're fading there. Well, since you and I are the same age, both of us born in 1940, I'm rooting for you because I'm certainly hoping that I will still be selling books at that age.
Why don't we celebrate it together?
We could do that. That would be absolutely wonderful, and possibly even in person and not over Zoom, because I'm home in my library, and due to the miracle of Zoom, Jeffrey is in England. So, you know, it's marvelous that we can do it this way. But the reason I digressed into that was that I did read in an interview that you did with an Indian paper, I think it was, that you were reluctant at the age of 79 to start a detective's story, your story of a detective, which necessarily was going to occupy several books and therefore several years. Why did you decide to do it if you were initially reluctant?
Well, there are you sitting there still working, and I suspect we're two of a kind. I don't want to stop working. I love work. Someone asked me the other day, why don't you lie on a yacht for the rest of your life and drink pina coladas? No, thank you. I want to write. I want to take William Warwick through to being commissioner. So like you, work is my great interest and my love. And indeed, you've just seen my wife. It's exactly the same for her. She never stops. I have no envy for people who, after they retire, go and live in a hot country. I was put on earth to work. You, Barbara, were put on earth to work. So we will both go on working.
Well, we will see. I came to this particular, you know, I asked you about whether politics or writing, you know, came first. And I came to book selling somewhat late, actually. This is the 32nd year of The Poison Pen. And I was almost 50 when I began it. And I didn't intend it to be a business, but it's run away with me. And now it actually is, for the benefit of our staff. And I love it. And you're right. I have no idea. I'll tell you what I did do, Jeffrey. Here's the thought. I'm giving it to my staff because that's my exit strategy. And I've already started that. But I did say to them, one in particular who was quite nervous, that it was going to be his job to tell me when I was past it. Because unfortunately, oftentimes as we age, if dementia overcomes us or something, we don't actually know that we're past it. So that's the flaw with the job that he's got, is that he's going to have to kick me out if I don't depart on my own.
I think it's different for a writer. I accept exactly what you're saying. And it will take him or her great courage to face you, Barbara, as you have built such an amazing reputation with The Poisoned Pen. In my own case, it will be the public who tell you. This book has gone straight to number one in several countries, and the early reviews are wonderful. When that stops, Barbara, I may well say, wait a minute, Jeffrey, they don't think you're any good any longer. That will be the time for me to get out. So whereas you have left this decision to a member of staff you respect, I will leave it always to the public to decide.
That's a very wise decision on your part, and I think correct, but it's hard for me to imagine that you will ever be past it. So our job today was actually to talk about the book, even though every Poison Pen interview ends up being digressions because it's so much fun, and also because we can't talk that much about the book without giving spoilers. But we can talk about some things and we won't. So one of the things I really enjoyed, Jeffrey, was the time here on the Pilgrim Line when William Warwick and his wife are traveling on a liner to New York. Now, I have a long history with Cunard. I sailed on the original Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth when I was 15 to Europe.
Wow.
I sailed on the Queen Elizabeth II with my sister, who was a speaker, and enjoyed her first class status, even though I was sleeping in a lower rank cabin. And we were on the inaugural voyage of the Queen Mary II. And so I recognized Cunard, I think, as the, for the Pilgrim Line. I mean, and so my question was, you must have sailed on Cunard because you write so tellingly about it.
Well, they have very kindly over the years asked me to lecture either about my years with Margaret Thatcher, or the other lecture they like is, would you like to be a bestseller? And they have kept calling me back again and again. And my wife and I have had the privilege of seeing half the earth on one of the most beautiful hotels in the world. So we've enjoyed it immensely. So Barbara, I regularly say to young writers and to people who want to be writers, write about what you know about, because the public will get it immediately. You don't have to write a ghost story. You don't have to write a violent crime story. You don't have to write a love story. Do what you feel at ease with. So I opened the book on a liner because I've been on several liners. And as you know, I opened it with a very bright young American who works out immediately that William Warwick is a detective. And as he wants to join the FBI, he sits down opposite him and starts quizzing him in a way only a truly bright American dares. We English take it for granted, but he gets a grip and asks him all the questions. And it's been a bit of a worry for me because, he was meant to be nothing more than an instrument to allow William Warwick to discover who the major criminal was. But the early reviews are saying they love him so much, the young American, that they want me to bring him back. Now, I must just tell you how he exists, because I like writing about people I've actually met, Barbara. I like writing about real people. And when I wrote Cain and Abel, I had a very remarkable researcher from Harvard who did the background work on the American side. And I remember once him heading towards me down Fifth Avenue, and he had a copy of The Spectator in one hand and a copy of The New Statesman in the other. And he said, oh yes, I read these every week because it keeps me up with what's going on in Britain, and I get both sides of the argument. So I couldn't resist doing that in the book, having this young man with a copy of The Spectator, with a copy of The New Statesman. And there I'd seen it. I'd seen a very clever young American doing just that. So I say to authors, when you spot something that's a tiny bit out of sync, the reader will believe it. They will think it happened.
Well, the main thrust of the story is not actually the case on the ocean liner, but there are two things that I took away from it. One, the chain of command in maritime occupations and running an ocean liner cruise ship is pretty definitive. And it's also true in the British police. Anyone who's been watching Line of Duty, which I have to tell you is a truly addictive police drama about corruption and so forth that is explored, knows that there's almost a military structure for how it works, lots of discipline and all. So William Warwick, who's from the police, and I'm not gonna spoil what happens, but there is something he investigates on the cruise liner. And the rules are such that he can't bring it to the conclusion that he would like. And I wondered, Jeffrey, if you did that, I mean, partly to illustrate the military structure of both, but also because in the larger case in this book, which is going after William Warwick's nemesis Miles, he's gonna have to break the rules. He's not going to be able to follow strict police procedure. Did you write the first one to highlight the fact that that was also true, that would also be true in a different structure on the ocean liner?
I think I set that sort of thing up accidentally, to be honest, Barbara. Mm-hmm. It goes a certain route and you kind of take advantage of it. And in my particular case, mentioning that background you talk about, I met, before I started the first of the William Warwicks, a Detective Chief Superintendent John Sutherland, who'd resigned from the Metropolitan Police when he was head of the murder squad. He had a mental breakdown on what he described was one murder too many. I went to see him. We actually met in church. We met at an Advent carol service for the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And I asked if he would be my researcher to make sure I didn't make silly mistakes about the police force. And he said he couldn't because he hadn't recovered enough from what had happened. And I hadn't started, so I waited patiently. And a year later, I approached him again. He said, yes, I think I am ready now. So I'm very privileged, Barbara, because I have this distinguished man who many people tipped to be commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. And I also have a Detective Sergeant Michelle Roycroft, also retired, who was in the drug squad. And the two of them, when I've done about four drafts, and I do 14, Barbara, when I've done about five drafts, I hand it over to both of them. I've not allowed them to meet each other. They still don't, after four books, know anything than the other person's name, unless they've met without telling me. And they read the books and point out, well, you can't do that if you're in the Metropolitan Police, Jeffrey, but you could do this. And that's pushing it a bit too far. You couldn't do that. But I remember an incident. And so I'm learning all the time, not only anecdotally, but for example, the drugs book, the number two book, I didn't know in Britain that 5 million people are on marijuana. I didn't know that 250,000 people are on cocaine or crack cocaine. I didn't know that 250,000 people were on heroin. And those are the facts you've got to get right, Barbara. Otherwise, the emails and the letters never stop. So it's a tremendous privilege having two former, very professional, very well-respected police officers checking the facts for me.
That is wonderful. I was actually going to ask you how you dealt with the finer points of police procedural. I remember years ago at a Crime Writers Association meeting, because I belonged to the British Crime Writers Association forever. I can't remember if it was Peter Lovesey or Robert Barnard, but anyway, I think it was Robert Barnard, talking about Christina Brand, who wrote some wonderful mysteries. And when it involved police, she knew zip about police and police procedures. So she had a standard line in all of her mysteries, which was, and the police went about their meticulous investigations, which was all she knew and all she said about policing. But you can't really do that now. So it's wonderful that you have consultants that are able to make sure that the policing parts are right.
Yes, it's a great privilege. It's a great privilege because you want your reader not only to enjoy the story and my attempt to make you turn the page, but to realize very quickly that it's authentic and correct. And you're quite right. You couldn't nowadays get away with the things. I always give the classic example of our great and distinguished Agatha Christie, who of course never suffered from two things. One, today, you could not call six people into a room and tell a story about each one of them without them calling for their lawyer. But more important, if she was writing today, what would she do about DNA? Because if she was writing in 2021, I have a friend who's a murder QC, and he tells me it's ruined his career. He doesn't win any cases now because of DNA. And Agatha Christie would have stayed the same. But Agatha Christie was such a brilliant storyteller. She would have adapted in the way Charles Dickens would have adapted. Of course, Conan Doyle would have adapted. They would have, whatever age they were in, they'd have been the best because they were great storytellers.
Well, technology has certainly blasted away a few wonderful mystery plots. Certainly the missing heir plot. Josephine Tay's Brad Farrar, one of my favorite books, for example, couldn't do it today. Dickens couldn't get away with Bleak House today. But you know what? When new theft comes along, as we saw with the Golden State Killer, which was a nonfiction success here, that new plots open up as old plots are retired And so that's great. I did want to point out to you something I really loved on page 30 of this wonderful book, when Franco, the waiter on the liner or Metro D, whatever he is, I'm trying to remember exactly how this goes. Anyway, they were referring back to the grandfather of the Pilgrim line, the older gentleman, and they said, "There, but for the grace of God, goes my grandfather. Several well-chronicled near misses and one appearance in court when the jury concluded not proven." In other words, he got away with things because of this Scottish judgment. And it reminded me, Marjorie Allingham wrote a book called The China Governess. And the whole point of The China Governess and the backstory was a trial in Scotland, and the end result was not proven. And that's a really interesting legal point that I'm not sure exists outside of Scottish law. But basically, it means you're guilty, but we just can't prove it because we don't have enough evidence.
That is correct, and it is Scottish law, not English law, which is it's an anomaly which we both live with. And going back to your earlier comments, yes, things have opened up because there are crimes you could never have dreamed of. Cybercrime, for example, and terrible crimes where people are stealing money by getting your identity and stealing your bank account. None of these crimes existed in the days of some of the writers you quite rightly so admire. So we modern writers have to adapt. And I suspect there'll be a Barbara Peters sitting there in 50 years' time, I hope saying, "Well, I loved Geoffrey Archer's Cain and Abel, but you know, you've got to live with the fact that he wrote it 50 years ago." And so all authors do that. And we can't adapt to what we literally don't know.
Absolutely true. You know, the best mysteries reflect the time, all the best novels reflect the time that they are written in. Yes. And, you know, you really do in our current cancel culture and culture wars. You know, there are some authors of great renown like Raymond Chandler who wouldn't survive writing today in the manner that he wrote, but you can't judge him by today's standard when he wrote then.
It was a great.
Let's move on to Miles.
Raymond Chandler, great storyteller.
He did, but he also he uses some terms that would be really offensive to a lot of people today.
That is an interesting topic, and an interesting. You're quite right. When you realize that Agatha Christie's most famous novel, And Then There Were None, had a title that is unacceptable to even raise on your program. And Graham Greene, arguably one of the greatest writers Great Britain has ever produced, his comments about the Jewish race would be quite rightly totally unacceptable today. And you are 100% right, Barbara. You have to try and take them in context.
You do. You don't want to boulderize things. You know, that would be an awful thing. For those, there was a reverend, I think his name was William Boulder, who decided, I think in the Victorian age, that he would clean up a lot of manuscripts to make them acceptable. And that's not okay with me. You have to accept literature as it was. But let's talk a little bit about
got that problem. Before you go on to that, Barbara, we've got a ridiculous situation in Britain at the moment.
Okay.
At one of our greatest theatres, the Globe Theatre, they are trying to teach Romeo and Juliet, removing the prejudices. Well, it's ridiculous. The man was born in the 1500s. He's the greatest writer my nation has ever produced. He's unquestionably the greatest poet my nation has ever produced. And by the way, he's not a bad storyteller, because if you don't know the end of Romeo and Juliet, you'd be sitting on the edge of your seat. So to try and sort him out now, 500 years later, is plain ridiculous.
Well, I don't disagree with you, and we won't even go into Rotello. Let's skip over that. But I did want to talk a little bit about Miles Faulkner, who's the bete noire of William Warwick, and is actually the principal case in this book, and it involves, we can't discuss it with spoilers, but I really love the way that he operates, that his reprehensible lawyer operates, the pressure that his ex-wife is under. And you know, one of the things you can take away from it is how much damage to so many people somebody like Miles can do.
Miles Faulkner is a loathsome individual, but you won't be surprised with your experience, Barbara, how many letters I get saying we want more of him, and is just as bad, distinguished QC, Mr. Booth, a Watson QC, who frankly will represent any criminal as long as he's paid. The two of them together become the bane of poor William Warwick's life. And here we are halfway through the series. I thought about getting rid of Miles Faulkner early on, but the public, the letters flooding in, didn't leave me in any doubt that he had to remain the main villain. So the challenge each time has been to give him a new crime to do. And as you know, he's married to this, well, she's a pretty cool lady, frankly, Christina, and she's not a lot better, in my opinion, than Miles Faulkner himself. So they're a good challenge. And it's wonderful that William Warwick's wife, Beth, is the head of a very great art institution in Britain and becomes a friend of Christina. And between them, they set about defeating Miles, as well as her husband trying to do it. And yes, you're quite right. I enjoyed immensely that challenge. And I have a confession. I'm like my readers, I enjoy writing about him, and I won't be killing him off. Well, not until the last book.
Maybe not. Well, you know, it's certainly true that, you know, the really great books depend on a superb villain in addition to a great protagonist. So, you know, when you think about Silence of the Lambs, how many talk about Clarice as opposed to going blank, you know, the Hannibal Lecter. And, you know, it's that duel that between worthy antagonists that is so enthralling to people.
But part of the genius of that particular film is Anthony Hopkins. What an amazing performance. I mean, actually, I've never seen him give a bad performance. I am among those privileged, and Americans listening to me may well be envious from a moment when I saw him play Anthony and Cleopatra at the National Theatre. So I've seen him on stage as well as on the film, and he knows, because we've chatted about it, what a huge admirer I am. But you're right, your point is well made, Barbara. The villains, and I'll tell you a little secret, they're easier to write than good people. You've got to be very careful with good people. You must give them flaws so they actually become human. And as you pointed out, they have even this perfect policeman, in order to catch Faulkner, has to bend the law, let's put it that way. But writing that was quite interesting, but writing a villain is much easier than writing a saint.
Well, as long as you're having fun, the reader will certainly have fun. You know, you can tell if the writer is bored, the reader will.
What do you mean by that? You can tell when the writer is bored. What an interesting statement.
Well, you can. There was a really interesting discussion. Lee Child had a little thing on YouTube. Lee's been a friend forever. So we've been through the whole Jack Reacher thing together. And in fact, we'll be launching the new Jack Reacher a week from Monday with Lee and Andrew. But Lee, and something I saw recently, was talking about readers, Jeffrey. And he said that really a book depends on its readers as much as it does upon the writer, or perhaps more. And I have, for years, there was a wonderful writer called Robert Eversose who said something to me years ago at the store, which I often quote, and I think it's true. And what he said was every book is actually three books. First one is that the book the author conceives and wishes to write. The second is the book the author actually writes, which isn't necessarily the book that he wished to write. But the third one, and this is the one I see, of course, as a bookseller, is the book that the reader interacts with. And every reader has a different experience with a book. Mm. I mean, every reader makes a book particular to the reader's life and experience. And if it's easy to see as a reader when a writer is what we call in America phoning it in, when it's just lazy writing, or whether it's repetitious writing, or there's no emotional impact, there's no heart, you know, in what people are saying. It's just kind of mechanical. I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, different.
Well, it's very interesting. But that is the reason I do 14 drafts. I attempt very hard indeed to make sure there isn't a wasted sentence, there isn't a wasted word. You're not going, I go on and on and on until I'm only correcting a word every three pages and only adding a line every 20. Because I think it's insulting to a reader to expect them to pay money and then find you're padding out some chapters, is what we call it in our country.
Well, but what I was really thinking, I mean, I could tell how much fun you had writing the ocean liner thing. I could tell that you'd been on Cunard, you know, and I could tell that you really enjoyed Miles Franklin in the way that the end, I mean, I can't discuss it because it'll be a spoiler, but there's a wonderful moment at the end when I could tell how much fun you were having writing that. That, you know, there was real emotion in what you've put in there. And that's what I meant. And I think, you know, obviously you wouldn't be a raging success if you hadn't managed to capture readers with, you know, both the quality of your writing and the care that you take, but also with the emotional impact that you put into it. Now, the Clifton Chronicles have had television, and that we have found, we're the Outlander bookstore, so there's nothing we don't know at the moment about the dramatic effect of television on a series. The appetite that it can foster for more, so forth. And the Clifton Chronicles, as I recall, you're telling really the story of the 20th century through this family, particularly Harry and all. And now in the William Warwick books, you're doing a similar thing, but you're starting in like the 1980s and working your way forward, because we're both still here and working our way forward.
I think he will become commissioner in about 2023. So I've taken it I always planned to take it from the days he was at school, right the way through to modern times, so that I could do modern crimes. And your comment about films is quite right. I have film companies chasing me once a week, but there is a big difference between them giving you a check for the rights and actually the film being made. No one will know better than you, Barbara. So I've had three television series. Cain and Abel was a very successful television series with Peter Strauss and Sam Neill. And of course, was partly responsible for the millions of books. You're quite right, the millions of books that were sold. But I would love another big television series, and the Clifton Chronicles, I think, is ideal for seven series in a row, just in case we've got a producer watching who won't just ring me up and say, oh, it's wonderful, you'll see it on the screen this time next year. Oh, God, no, just do it.
Well, doing it and doing it well are two different things, but nonetheless, long-form television is really, you know, entering into a golden age. There have been few benefits from the pandemic, one of which you're actually seeing right here in real time, which is that Jeffrey and I are having a conversation from, you know, enormously wide geographical separation here, and that's a real joy. But the other is that long-form storytelling on video platforms, on film platforms, has really flourished. And despite the controversy swirling around Netflix at the moment and so forth, it does mean that lots of wonderful books, lots of wonderful series are making it onto television. But what I thought was interesting, Jennifer, you've written, you know, we already talked about how you love short stories, which necessarily are, you know, standalone, and you've written a lot of standalone novels. But with the Clifton Chronicles, you obviously had a long story you wanted to tell that you broke into segments. And clearly now with William Warwick, as you've been describing it, there's an overarching story, and then, you know, you've got individual stones that you're putting into place. And that really is a natural for the kind of television that we're talking about.
Absolutely, 100%. And I have been approached on both, and nothing has happened. And they now, one of them became free again last week. The Clifton Chronicles became free again. I will tell you here and now, which will drive my agent, because you said one sentence that really came home to me, Some of them are made into good television series. And what you meant, of course, is some aren't. I would sell the Clifton Chronicles, all seven volumes, for $1 if you could give me a series that people rush to see once a week. Because that, funnily enough, no one knows it better than you, that's what sells books. And I don't want a bad television series. I want one everyone is talking about. Maybe that's why I've been very fussy and haven't yet found the right people to do the job.
Well, you know, I mean, Outlander is an obvious one, but I could refer you to the Walt Longmire series written by Craig Johnson and how that dramatically lifted his sales. And as we speak, Mark Graney, who writes wonderful books, has got an amazing movie coming out. Jack Carr, who's a rising star, Vince Flynn, sort of Jack has a real background as a Navy SEAL. His mother was a librarian. So that kind of inspired my question to you earlier, right, is that Jack right. will tell you that he became a Navy SEAL so that he could write books. He didn't become a Navy SEAL and then write books. The whole point of becoming a Navy SEAL was to fulfill his childhood dream inspired by his mother to be a writer and to gain the experience in doing that. But he has a phenomenal movie or long form. I can't remember which one it is. And so I'm on the brink. These are all authors we work with. CJ Box is another one. He has Big Sky on television, and then Joe Pickett is being filmed in Calgary. And I remember back to Colin Dexter, Jeffrey. I mean, nobody really knew Colin Dexter all that much until Morse came along. I mean, he won, what was it, the Gold Dagger for his Victorian mystery in Oxford, name which I can't recall, but was a really interesting story. It was made into TV. And then, you know, Morse came along. We're still seeing Morse. I mean, Endeavor is making a new appearance.
But so you've hit the same thing again, if I may say so.
Sure.
John Thor was a beautiful performance. He gave a beautiful performance as Morse. Yeah. Dexter's a fine writer to begin with. But as you pointed out, Barbara, if they hadn't done a good adaptation,
right,
Morse would not have made it. And John Thor is a beautiful actor. And it was one of the tragedies of my life that he rang me up a few months before he died and said that he wanted to do one of my short stories, Old Love, which he really enjoyed. And I said, well, I can't think of anyone I would rather have do it. But that is overshadowed by, here's one for you, Barbara. I'm so old that I had a call from William Wilder, from the great man himself. He wanted to make Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less. And he died a few months later. So don't ring me, because the odds are you'll die a few months later.
All right, we'll stick to Zoom. That's a really terrifying thought. You know, on that cheerful note, I think we should call Patrick up. This is my Shakespeare director moment. I love doing this. Come along, Patrick, come back and tell us if we have any questions from the audience that you might like to reveal. Isn't this great? I love the way Zoom works, that Patrick's lurking there in the background. Yeah. Now here he is again.
Lurking. Wow. Good word, that. Lurking.
Lurking. Yeah, I'm good at that. What a wonderful conversation. Let me see here. And I'd like to thank everybody who's watching on YouTube as well as Facebook. This is, the second time we've streamed simultaneously. Yes, Nicholas has a couple of questions for you, and some of this you've already partially answered, but he says, how do you get the inspiration to write a novel? Presumably you outline everything beforehand. How much time do you find yourself staring into space, wondering what to write next?
I have to answer that question totally honestly, Nicholas. Being a storyteller is a God-given gift. I'm not a ballet dancer. I'm not a painter. I don't play the violin. I have never stared into space. It comes every day of my life. I can't stop it. I am a storyteller. It is a gift. I would love to conduct the Royal Philharmonic at the Albert Hall. I would love to open the batting for England at cricket. I would love to have been Prime Minister, but I failed all of those, but was very privileged and very lucky to be given this strange gift to tell a story. So the honest answer, Nicholas, is I never stop. It comes out. I get up at 6 a.m. I work for 2 hours, 6 to 8. I work 10 to 12, 2 hours, 2 to 4, 2 hours, 6 to 8 again before I go to bed about 9:30. I handwrite every word and I do 14 or 15 drafts before I allow anyone to see it. So I am meticulously professional, but frankly, it doesn't matter how particularly professional you are. In the end, you have to be able to tell a story.
It's interesting how many writers we've spoken with recently have said that they write by hand, as you do. Yeah. Let's see. Monisha, I hope I got that right, is also a big fan of your short stories. And she says, will there be more in the future? I just love them.
Well, that's very kind of you. And most of the awards I've won have been for short stories. So I will say to you, if I live to 90, and Barbara and I both intend to live to 90, yes, you'll get another set of short stories. One of the strange things about the pandemic was I missed the theater because I go twice a week. I've been to the theater in London 5 times in the last 3 weeks. I missed the conversations with dear and intelligent and lovable friends. But do you know what I didn't get and missed even more was short stories? Because I meet so many interesting people, I often get an anecdote. I often get an incident that's happened to them, which I'm able to turn into a short story. And I'm afraid COVID stopped me doing that. And I became very aware of it. No sooner had I come out of lockdown in COVID than I met a man on one of the cruises. We were doing a very short cruise for the launch of a new ship. And he said, I've got a story for you. And any author will tell you, oh God, please may I fall asleep now, or may he just go away. And he told me my whole next book in one sentence. Now that has never happened before. And it was simply an idea he put to me. And I went away and thought about it and realized, here's the fascinating thing, he should never have told me. He was in a position to tell me because of the position he held, and he should never have told me. And it's been in there ever since, buzzing around like a lunatic. So the answer to your question is I have 4 more William Warwicks to do. And if the good Lord has spared me, I shall be doing some more short stories.
Fantastic. A question that we often get, which is, what do you yourself like to read? Do you read fiction? Do you read nonfiction? How do your tastes go?
My favorite author, and I really commend him to you, and I'm sure Barbara's read him because she seems to have read everything. My favorite author is the great Stefan Zweig, whose novel Beware of Pity I consider to be a genuine masterpiece. And Stefan Zweig's genius is quite simply that he's not only a natural born storyteller, he's arguably the greatest writer in the last 100 years. He went particularly out of fashion. He left Austria, Jewish. He left Austria and went to New York. and went on writing. He was number one on the equivalent of the New York Times bestseller. He was the biggest success on earth. He committed suicide, and sadly, his books just came off the shelves. And he's just been bought back in England. I'm sure he's in the United States, by the Pushkin Press. And he's getting big audiences. And I'll tell you why, because he's blooming wonderful. And it's a privilege to read him. I read him. His nonfiction books, by the way, for those of you who never read fiction or read more nonfiction, his nonfiction books on Europe in the lead up between 1930 and Hitler coming to power are the best of that subject I've read. So we're dealing here with a truly remarkable writer who was blessed with being a storyteller as well.
I'm so glad you mentioned Pushkin Vertigo. They are actually are here in the United States and getting active. They published a number of Japanese authors that people would probably otherwise not know.
They're giving a great service by bringing back, sometimes by alerting us to authors from abroad. There hasn't been a translation, or they haven't got going, and also alerting us to some of the greatest authors that have ever lived that have kind of disappeared and really should be in the lexicon of books.
Anything else, Patrick?
Yeah, this is actually more of a comment. It's Nicholas again, and he says, one of the nicest things about your books is that they are not so convoluted that you have to go back and reread. He says, it's nice to be able to read a simple story and get lost in a good book. And I think people forget how difficult it is to do that.
Well, I'm glad that I spend hours trying to make it look simple.
Right.
I spend hours trying to make you turn the page and think it's simple. It's a great compliment, because I assure you, it's not done easily or quickly.
Let me add too that one of the things that I particularly enjoyed in Over My Dead Body is that there are different point of view characters. It's not just one perspective. So, you know, we hear from the lawyer, we hear from William Warwick, and I like that. It's a much fuller picture of what's going on than if you just are focused in from the single point of view. Is that same thing, Jeffrey, you've always done, or did you, as you've grown over the years, have you found that's the best way to tell a story?
That's a fair question. I had a great privilege early in my life as a writer, very great privilege, Barbara. I was edited by the legendary Coley Smith, who edited J.D. Salinger. And it was like having a tutorial at Oxford. I mean, I literally sat at his feet and listened. I've always thought that Simon & Schuster, who published that book, paid me the greatest service of all by allowing arguably the greatest editor, one of the great editors of the last century, to deal with me when I was a child and to make Cain and Abel a higher standard. So I believe editors to be very important indeed. And the American, I have to say, I think the Americans take editing more seriously than almost any other nation on earth. Oh yes, I think you have. The editors I've had in the United States have been exceptional. But of course, Cain and Abel was a classic example, because he rang me up before I'd ever met the great man. And he rang me up, and I had written Cain and Abel, and I'd written 120 pages of Cain and 120 pages of Abel. And he rang me up and said, look, I just want to say, Jeffrey, that when I read 120 pages of Cain, I didn't want to meet Abel. And when I'd read 120 pages of Abel, I didn't want to meet Cain. So can I suggest, he said, that we have 5 pages of Cain, 5 pages of Abel, 12 pages of Cain, 12 pages of Abel, 20 pages of Cain, 20 pages of Abel, 30 pages of Cain, 30 pages of Abel, and then they meet for the first time. They only meet once, and it changes their whole life. Now, Barbara, that's brilliant editing. He didn't write a word. And funnily enough, it wasn't that difficult to do, because the 120 pages were there. So I was able to split them and do small rewrites. But it was his amazing brain that said, that'll make this book a bestseller. And Simon & Schuster's boss at the time, Joni Evans, told me a lovely story. She said, you know, when Cain and Abel came out and stormed all over the world, we just got books that were 3 pages of this, 3 pages of that, 12 pages of this, 12. And I said to Joe, well, that was the great Paul E. Smith. That was not me.
Well, he obviously was a genius at structure. Structure is so terribly important to making a story work. And, you know, I was thinking, I didn't work it in, but I was thinking back, Manette Walters was had a conversation with me at the store years ago and said something that I think is so true. And she said, it really matters that a book has an end as good as the beginning. And, yes. You know, too often it's easy to have a brilliant idea, you know, and fly off with it. But to deliver the punch at the end that matches the punch of the beginning takes a lot of work. It isn't just luck that gets you there.
No, I'm afraid it isn't. And you've made that comment because there's one author, and I will not name him under any circumstances. He's one of the finest authors I've ever read in my life. He just can't end a book. He does not know how to end a book. You go, if it's a 400-page book, you get to page 350, you think, I'm in the presence of a genius. And then for the last 50, he just sort of tries to escape. But he's unquestionable. He's a prize winner. He writes beautifully. I read every one of his books. But he has, you're quite right, Barbara, it's a different skill altogether. I've never heard it put the way you put it, which is interesting, that you must end the book as strongly as you open it. That's a very interesting comment.
Well, that's Manette Walters. I'm merely quoting her. But I think that she was absolutely right. And it reminds me, I'm going to wind this up with a funny story. He's now dead, so I won't embarrass him. But Bob Barnard, I thought, was a really wonderful, clever writer and kind of a golden age mystery writer. And I loved his plots. I mean, he even had one in which the complicated question of quarantine a dog if you bring it into England turned out to be the motive for the murder. I mean, he could make spin gold out of straw any old time. But he did write one book, and the end of it was absolutely awful. It took place, I think, again on a liner, and you thought you knew where it was going, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the IRA shows up, and you know, from nowhere. And that's the end of the book. And I said to Bob, because I went to his Diamond Dagger, Scribner's publisher sent his editor and me to London for his Diamond Dagger Award. And I said to him, Bob, I meant to ask you for years, what was with the IRA? I mean, what did you do? And he said, you know, he says, the only time it happened to me, he said, but my deadline was there and I just couldn't think of an ending. So I threw in the IRA.
That's unforgivable, Barbara. Yeah. I would say to my publisher, I have not finished. I am not ready. I will send it when I am. I would never want one of my books.
Well, that would have been the right answer, but in any case, but he didn't. And I forgave him and readers did, because he really normally was just a genius at plotting, but he let that one get away from him. But it underlines Manette's point, which is, you know, no reader wants to invest time in getting to page whatever it is, 290, only to discover that there's no ending that satisfies. So, you know, how wonderful that you always do produce this. And certainly I love the ending of Over My Dead Body, which alas, we can't talk about. So Patrick, was there anything else or should we thank everybody for watching?
Let's I have one more that just came in. Vicky asks, she says, the Clifton Chronicles were so magnificent. Did you have it all plotted out from the beginning and know where it was going to end?
Do you know, Vicky, I didn't have it plotted after the fifth page. I knew it was a young man born in the back streets of Bristol. I then decided he would win a scholarship to Bristol Grammar School. I then decided his best friend would be the owner of a shipping line. I then decided he'd fall in love with the sister of his best friend, and took it from there. And 7 books later, there's a eulogy to him in St. Paul's Cathedral. So no, I took it from page to page, from chapter to chapter, and then sat down and said, what will Harry do next? And then sat down and said, what will Harry and Emma do next? And it just went on. And Emma's based on my wife, who's had a brilliant and distinguished career. She's currently chairman of the Science Museum in Great Britain, having been chairman of Cambridge University's hospital, and the Queen has made her a dame. So it was very easy to take a strong woman and put her in Emma's place. I also had the privilege of working for 11 years with Margaret Thatcher, so I know a strong woman when I see one. And the combination of both, they get into my books because I love writing about strong women. But the answer to your question is no. When I sat down to write the Clifton Chronicles, it was originally going to be three books. The publishers begged me to make it five, and by five, they were still only 50 years old. So I went on to write seven. And as Barbara said, you've still got to have an ending, but they had to take them from 50 to 70. You can't kill them all off on the same day at 50. And so I did take them on to 70. And I have been touched by how many Americans have written about the Clifton Chronicles. And I hope you will enjoy the William Warwicks, Vicky, as much as the Clifton Chronicles.
Speaking of strong women, I have read that Lady Virginia in the Clifton Chronicles
is really woman.
A really remarkable.
She's a wicked woman. I had a wonderful situation with her. I put her in court against one of the best QCs, one of the best Queen's Counsels in the country. And in answer to Vicky, I decided that morning I was going to demolish the wicked Virginia, finish her, because my heroine, Emma, deserved retribution. So I put her in the witness box and she got the first question from the QC and she batted it away. And I thought, that's tricky. We'll have to ask another question. And we asked another question and she batted it away. And I thought, well, this is going the wrong way. And I asked another question and she batted. And so I switched it to her killing the QC, winning the case, and my heroine having to live with that. So that's what I mean by I don't know where I'm going or what is going to happen. But you've got to do that, Vicky, because when you do it, the reader will go with you and they don't know what's going to happen either.
Well, we come back to our point about how much emotion the author himself invests in the story he's telling is always the winner. So, Jeffrey, this has really been fascinating. What a real pleasure and a privilege it has been to talk to you today. Now, this is in the U.S., this is the launch of the book, which I think publishes actually on Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken. So thank you very much for giving us this opportunity. I want to thank everybody who's watched it. There will be a podcast available in a day or so, so you can recommend for people to listen to it. And the video will stay on our Facebook and YouTube pages forever, so you can recommend it to your friends. I certainly hope that we get to do this with the next William Warwick.
Can I just say, as we're ending, Barbara, it is a real privilege for an Englishman to go to number one on the New York Times. And I heard John Grisham say on a show that it was a real privilege to go to number one on the London Times for an American. And I was touched by that because the Americans have been so good to me over the years. And of course they know how much I love your country, how much I follow your politics, how much I follow everything. I mean, the Trump-Biden saga has been the best, frankly, the best novel I've ever seen. And it was played out right.
You could never have made it up. Absolutely.
Never have made it up. No one would have believed it. And by the way, we still don't know how it's going to end.
We don't. So we'll see if the end is as good as the beginning in real time.
Right.
That's a wonderful way to end it. Goodbye, everybody. Good evening, Jeffrey. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.